Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and writer David Halberstam was an icon of American journalism. He died yesterday in a car crash in California. He was 73. In the early years of the Vietnam War, Halberstam infuriated John F. Kennedy with his tough, critical reporting of the realities of Vietnam, realities that ultimately led to America's withdrawal. He would call that war America's greatest tragedy since the Civil War. Now the country is at war again. Up next on Point, friends and colleagues on David Halberstam and the American media at war in his war, Vietnam, and in Iraq today. We will hear in this hour from correspondents who knew David Halberstam from Vietnam and later, important voices in their own right. We'll also listen back to the remarkable voice and insights of David Halberstam himself in his many appearances on this show. Joining me first today in the studio here is David Greenway, longtime foreign correspondent for Time, Life, and The Washington Post. He was in Saigon when the city fell, April 30th, 1975. He's currently foreign affairs columnist for the Boston Globe. David Greenway, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
From Washington, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Neil Sheehan is with us. In the 1960s, he covered the conflict in Vietnam for United Press International and, like Halberstam, for the New York Times. In 1971, he helped publish the Pentagon Papers, the secret government history of that war. In 1988, he published A Bright, Shining Lie, John Paul Vann and America in Vietnam, for which he won the Pulitzer. Neil Sheehan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Nice, good to be with you, Tom.
And from Washington, also, William Prock now. He was a reporter for the Seattle Times during the Vietnam War and is author of Once Upon a Distant War, David Halberstam, Neil Sheehan, Peter Arnett, Young War Correspondents and Their Early Vietnam Battles. Bill Prochnow, thank you for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Neil Sheehan, let me turn first to you, if I may, and I want to fully acknowledge the human dimension of the news that we all got late yesterday or early this morning of this tragic death of David Halberstam in an automobile accident in Menlo Park, California. He was being driven out to yet another interview in his long life of interviews. His car broadsided, and David Halberstam dead at the scene. Before we even go to history, I want to give you a chance, Neil, just to share with us your sentiments on this sad day.
Well, it was a tremendous shock for me because David was my best friend. It was ironic that a man who went through all the dangerous turns that David did would die in a car accident. But that's the way I guess life is. I mean, there's no replacing him. He was an original. He was what the French call an original. And they broke the mold after David. He was an extraordinary person, and there will be no replacing him.
Take us back to those days in Vietnam when you and he were very young and very much in the thick of things. Did he know at that time that y'all collectively were engaged in changing the mind of a nation about a war that had been misrepresented in many ways?
No, we were intent on focused on getting the truth about the war into print. We weren't thinking really beyond that. We thought that if we did get the truth of the war into print, that the president and the Kennedy administration would do something about it to change things and fight the war the right way in Vietnam. We were young men of our generation. We believed in all the shibboleths of the Cold War. We thought Vietnam was the right war, the right time, the right place. And it took some time for us to get disillusioned on that score. But the big battle was to try to report the truth about what was happening in Vietnam, which was that we were losing the war. And the high command, the General Harkins, the commanding general, and Frederick Nolting, the ambassador, were both maintaining that they were winning the war. And it was a tremendous struggle for two young reporters, neither of whom had any reputation. David didn't have a Pulitzer then, and I was 26 years old. He was 29. And here we were being here we were contradicting the powers that be, and there was a tremendous amount of pressure on you all the time. So you were struggling all the time to get the truth out.
Bill Prochnow, you wrote the book on these young correspondents, David Halberstam, Neil Sheehan, Peter Arnett, and their reporting efforts in those early and mid-1960s years of the Vietnam War. Bring us an anecdote or two from that time, if you would, to illustrate the enterprise that they were engaged in there.
Well, I think it was a rather remarkable thing all around in that, as was just said, the truth was being denied right and left in Vietnam, not just by the military at all, but I think primarily by the civilians on down and through the top brass of the military. One of the best things that happened, I think Neil would agree, to the reporters there was that the top people started shutting them out, just wouldn't tell them anything in effect, or told them lies over and over. And they were forced then, without sources, to go out and build sources in the field, and that's where they found the truth. And it wasn't working, and it wasn't going to work. And they reported it, and because of that, they literally became the enemies of almost everyone, including a large part of the press corps, and their own bosses. It was a very, very tough time. A unique, really unique time in 20th century journalism. Mm-hmm. They changed it.
Mm-hmm. Neil, we want to hear more about that, but David Greenway, HDS Greenway, with me in the studio. The Halberstam legacy, it's sad to even have to speak in these terms. He, dead only yesterday, and yet he's been such an icon for so long. We're not just waking up to his imprint this morning.
Yes, indeed. I think he and his band of brothers, that Neil was one of them, set the bar on how to talk truth to power during wartime. And when my generation came to Vietnam reporting,
later in the 60s,
mm-hmm. and then in the 70s, it was no longer possible to just take the word of press officers and embassy officials and generals. You had to go out in the field and talk to Vietnamese and younger officers who were more inclined to tell you the truth. So the path that those guys set, Neil and David and Mal Brown and et al., was the one that became the way to report the war after that, that nobody ever went back to the
handout journalism.
Yes, and get on the team journalism. That the pressure to join a propaganda effort was mm-hmm. totally ignored after that.
Speaking truth to power as a pattern set there, Neil Sheehan, was it conscious?
No, it wasn't at the beginning, and really it was the start of the credibility gap. You have to, and although we didn't realize that, you have to remember that prior to Vietnam, the American press corps in general, the American news media in general, were still operating in the shadow of World War II, mm-hmm. and their attitude toward authority had been formed by World War II. If you got a briefing from George Patton in France and what he was going to do to the Germans, you get a pretty good idea of what was going to happen to the Germans. Mm-hmm. And this man knew what he was doing, and he had a grasp on reality. Mm-hmm. And so senior military figures, senior diplomatic figures, had great credibility when we went to Vietnam as young men. Mm. And then suddenly you have these people and they're in Never Never Land. This is the commanding general is deluded, the ambassador is deluded, and you find yourself in a situation where senior authority no longer is believable. And that was unprecedented, and we didn't realize that it was all we knew was that we were caught in this struggle. And we were determined to get the truth out, and they did us a favor in the sense that you could not get virtually anything from the official spokesman. So you went out and you formed your own sources, your own Vietnamese sources, your own sources in the field, and American among younger American officers who agreed with us.
Neil, let me ask you, the story you're telling right there seems so horribly relevant today. Did you and David Halberstam speak about the path you carved out then and whether or not it's surviving in Iraq now, whether there's a repetition underway here of that Vietnam syndrome?
You mean in Iraq?
In Iraq, yes.
Well, it could be. I mean, it certainly is as far as what you hear from the White House and the senior levels of the State Department, and a lot of what one reads of what the senior generals have said in Iraq applies just as well, although it's much more difficult for reporters to cover Iraq because it's so dangerous just to get out. The environment is so dangerous that it's very difficult for them to get out and cover the war. But yes, there was a definite echo there, obviously.
David Halberstam was a frequent guest on this show, for which we were always grateful. His voice, a very distinctive one. Just days after the show went to air, he joined us to talk about leadership in American history. This was just after the attacks of 9/11, 2001. I asked him about relevant historic parallels to 9/11.
Well, I think Pearl Harbor is self-evident, and leadership. I mean, the West was extraordinarily lucky in those days. You had Churchill in England, de Gaulle in France, who operated outside of his own country by radio voice. It was a radio era. Franklin Roosevelt, who that very first day said, you know, a day that will live in infamy. And had earlier, I think, had said, not on that occasion, but in terms of leadership, a rendezvous with destiny. I mean, words were more important in that era. We have television and images now, but I think it's terribly important for the president, you know, to set what the national mood is, what our goals are, what is expected of the country, what is expected of individuals. I mean, this has been a country that has been binging materially and self-absorption for 12 years, as if the rest of the world didn't matter since the fall of the Berlin Wall. And so you've moved into a new era, and it's a very different era, and how you set the tone of this and what you expect of the American people and want from them, that's a critical matter.
David Halberstam speaking with us here at On Point just days after 9/11. David Halberstam dead yesterday in a car crash in California at age 73. David Greenway, here's this voice of historical memory looking at that shocking event of 9/11, and it makes us think about what's lost when you lose a journalist in this case of the years and authority to look out with that kind of memory and credibility.
Well, of course, it's an enormous loss, and as Neil said, they broke the mold. I think that you can take some of the excellent books today that dismantle what's been going on in Iraq and all the mistakes and all the
Anthony
lies.
Anthony Shadid, Tom Rixon, right on.
George Packer.
Of course.
All of those books march in David Halberstam's shadow. They are all this war's best and the brightest. Mm. So they owe a great debt to the best and the brightest.
Bill Prochnow, there's of course the story, maybe apocryphal, maybe not, maybe you know, that President Kennedy put the arm on the publisher of the New York Times during the Vietnam War, Arthur Oxelsberger, to get Halberstam out of there because his reporting was just too painful. Has that been confirmed?
Well, I think that's quite true, yeah. I mean, I don't have any way, personal way of confirming it, but it's been told often enough and by the people that were involved that I think that it's quite true. It was subtle, you know. Things like that are usually subtle, but they wanted him out of there. They wanted all of them out of there. They didn't want Neil, the UPI, who Neil was working for at the moment, they didn't want Neil there. They were all in trouble with their bosses, and they were all in trouble with the government a big time. I think one of the differences between Iraq and Vietnam is that while the books are coming out now, the early journalism probably didn't have the group that would have served us well to have had that kind of reporting when we first went in. We had some of it, obviously. Mm. Rix was one of them. Rix was terrific at the beginning. and terrific in his book. It's a blow you away book about what was wrong in Iraq.
Thomas Risk, Fiasco in Iraq.
Also, as I think Neil made the point, I mean, it's how do you cover Iraq? I mean, some of the largest papers in the country are having trouble finding people to serve for a year over there as bureau chief because you get to cover it from your hotel room or a very guarded caravan or something.
Everybody's very bunkered. Neil Sheehan, what about the sort of uptake on Iraq, a standard set maybe in the Vietnam War for reportage? Now a lot of books on the table, but there was that early push post 9/11 that went. Were the Vietnam lessons forgotten for a time there?
Well, I think the people who led us to war in Iraq had divorced themselves from the experience in Vietnam. With the exception of Colin Powell, who gave that astonishing and terribly sad performance at the United Nations and betrayed his own principles and everything he had learned in Vietnam. If we had a president who'd been involved in Vietnam as a young man, which we didn't. I mean, you've got to remember the president avoided the war. The vice president avoided the war. The secretary of defense wasn't involved, and the deputy secretary of defense, Paul Wolfowitz, avoided the war. All of these men. If you came to someone who'd gone through and lived the Vietnam experience and said, "Let's go off and have a war of choice in Iraq," which was a very divided and fractious society, where you were bound to get in deep trouble if you went in there, you'd say, "No, thank you. I mean, that you're proposing that I contract a social disease here. Thank you. No, thank you. I mean, it's the last thing they would have done. But we were led into it by an administration which had no conception, I don't think, of what they were getting involved in because they hadn't been, they lacked the experience of Vietnam. And they saw 9/11 as a way to do things that they wanted done, and they thought that Iraq would be an easy victory, a cheap victory.
David Greenway?
Do you think that's a possibility it could be even worse than divorcing themselves from the Vietnam War? That Cheney and Rumsfeld were around when Saigon fell in the government. Mm-hmm. There's a picture of them sitting with President Ford.
Gerald Ford, right.
Do you think that they may have thought they've taken the wrong lesson away from Vietnam?
That the country had taken the wrong lesson?
Yes.
Maybe through the pen of reporters like Halberstam.
And that they had basically won it by 1972, and that if we did it again, we could get it right.
Neil?
Well, there's a myth, that a revisionist myth on the war, that the war had been won by the latter stage of the war. It's total nonsense. I mean, the weakness, as I try to point out in the book I've written on Vietnam, A Bright Shining Light, the weaknesses that brought down the Saigon regime, the Saigon government we were backing, were very pronounced, and we had changed nothing by 1972. But a myth has arisen, and it's possible to some extent they thought if only we'd persisted in Vietnam, which you hear, we would have won the war, which is rubbish. I mean, the Saigon government was unable to stand on its own, and once the American advisors were withdrawn and the American air power was withdrawn, it just collapsed.
I think it's very hard to, persistence. What is it, 12, 15 years? What is persistence? And Neil was there in 72, I believe, beginning the work on his book.
Yes, I did.
It was the Vietnam was a disaster in 72. There was a point in 68. There's some controversy over the Tet Offensive, and maybe we would have could we have gone from there, and did the Viet Cong really lose? And the press interpreted it wrong, and the government interpreted it wrong. I don't believe that. I don't think too many people that watch it closely do. I think the military probably believes it. But Vietnam, I always, when I'm asked the question about winning Vietnam, I say, well, what would we have done with it when we won it? leave 500,000 troops over there for the next 30 years?
All these
We're
questions.
We're better off now with Vietnam than we would have been if we had won it.
These questions echo with such currency. I want to bring the voice of David Halberstam in again, if I may, here again from September 20th, 2001, just a week and change after the attacks of 9/11, and already the country was talking, the White House and others talking about this as a new kind of war that was afoot. I asked him if it, even then, this is before Iraq, if it, he had any deja vu feeling here, hearkening back to Vietnam. Here's his reply.
I think it's much more like the Cold War. I think Kennedy's phrase, long twilight struggle, is an apt one. I think the leadership, I think you really want to go back to the moments at the beginning of the Cold War, Truman, Acheson, Kennan, people like that, that took a distant threat that the rest of the ordinary American people did not really know how to respond to, and set goals. And when the country really was very slow responding to it, and they did this well, they did it skillfully, they did it, I think, quite calmly, and we set a certain mission which the country came along in, whether it was the Marshall Plan, NATO, and whatever. I think this is parallel. I mean, I think what you're talking here really is a long twilight struggle.
A long twilight struggle coming up, David Halberstam saying there in September 2001. Not exactly a strategic recipe for the Iraq War. David Halberstam sadly dead yesterday at 73. Let me turn to our listeners, if I may. A lot of them want to join us. From Simsbury, Connecticut, Jack is on the line. Jack, you're on the air.
Tom, thank you for this thoughtful tribute to a great contributor to American society, and thanks to your producers as well. I just want to contribute that as a reader of Halberstam, what he should be remembered for are his deeds, and not so much what people are saying, but actually to read his books, and you see the depth with which he wrote, which is the antithesis of what American media, this show accepted, has become, which is to divide our consciousness into little 10-second clips and to gobble up and swallow absolutely everything that authority position, whether it's in your corporation or whether it's in your government, feeds you at face value. He was one who carefully sought out the truth, and when he chewed carefully and swallowed it and decided that it was the truth, he was completely unafraid to publish and to go with it. And those kinds of people in American media are extremely rare. I think you can even put it in this day's context when you look at the Tillman hearings on Capitol Hill.
Pat Tillman, of course.
That positions represented as absolute truth turn out to be not quite what they were represented as. I think if Halberstam were on that story, that the truth would have come out a lot sooner. Thank you.
Jack, thank you very much for your call. Let me get one more here. Bob from Boston. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, I had the great privilege and a good time working with David Halberstam as a college correspondent when he was going to Harvard with his brother Michael, who was equally a great writer. And the thing about David that even then showed its face was that he asked the tough questions. We were probably interviewing football coaches, but he had that ability to think ahead and really ask the questions, and having known him for a long time, it's a sad day.
From the get-go, that readiness to ask, and of course cutting his teeth in the civil rights movement, working at the Tennessean in Nashville, and then off to Vietnam. Bob, thank you for that. Let me get a call from Northeastern Massachusetts. Sue, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, and hello to your wonderful guests. Question that I'll take the answer off the air.
Yeah.
Did David Halberstam ever express frustration about the power of the press today to affect change by speaking truth to power?
We'll take it straight up, Sue, and thanks. Neil Sheehan, what about it? Did you talk about the state of the American media today, the speaking truth to power function?
Well, I think, yes, I did with David. But I think, you know, David lamented, and I think everyone laments, the coming of what I call press lordism, which you see in something like Fox News, where you don't get the straightforward, honest reporting. You get somebody's preconceived view of what of the situation. I mean, one saw that in Fox's coverage of the war in Iraq. The headline of the program was covered Iraq Operation Iraqi Freedom, which was the Pentagon's slogan for the operation. Time magazine was guilty of that in the old days at times, not always. The reporters for Time magazine were wonderful guys, but you had editors in New York who would who would simply make things up and change what they were getting, what they were getting from their reporters in the field. And that sort of thing goes on, has gone on now, with the coming of people like Murdoch and press lordism, and it's very sad. It gets in the way of reporting the truth.
David Greenway, I first met Halberstam in Japan when he was working on his big book on the U.S. auto industry and how it failed to meet the Japanese challenge. Spoke with him later about, you know, how he put those great big books together, and he described his very systematic system. He would have deep stacks of index cards full of quotes and data and facts, and he would just line them up and write through these enormous, great, often society-changing tomes.
I think also he could write very, very fast. He was just a vacuum cleaner as a reporter and then could move it out very, very quickly. And, of course, his breadth was so enormous. I mean, you mentioned the sports reporting. Almost my favorite book was the book about the lonely rowers and a sport that no one had ever appreciated. And and the other thing you got to say about...
Wrote about Michael Jordan, wrote about the firemen after 9/11, was on his way to interview the quarterback there for the great NFL game.
But he was also extremely generous to comrades and other, especially younger people coming up that he could help. And I think his generosity should be mentioned here as one of his great traits.
But William Prock, now, when he was at it in Vietnam, hard-nosed in the field going for his stories.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Just that when he was at it early on in Vietnam, this was a tough customer.
Oh, he's a tough customer. People have described him in all the proper ways on this show. I mean, this is a guy who just is a dynamic person who filled a room.
I want to play, if I may, a clip here from David Halberstam, who was very generous with his time with this show. This one from much more recently, just last fall, October 23rd, 2006, last fall. He joined us to look at Iraq. The week before his appearance, and this is a long clip, Neil, David, William, I hope you'll bear with us here, but we have a hunger for this voice today. The New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman had put the Tet Offensive label on recent violence in Iraq. I asked David Halberstam, this is October last year, whether that label was fair and useful, a useful comparison to make. Halberstam expressed his reservations.
No one's really defined what they mean by Tet. And I think Tet was an enormous bench line and a reflection of failure and the whole country, our country, realizing that it didn't work. And the people on the right who seize on Tet like to say it was a political defeat but a military victory for us. And in a political war, which Vietnam was and certainly Iraq is, there is no such thing. You cannot have a military victory that is a political defeat. Everything is political. And up to Tet, the United States government, Rostow and Johnson and people like that, had been saying, in effect, the other side is about to fall out of the trees, they're almost ready to surrender, our power is working, when in fact that was not true, that our journalism, in fact, if anything, underestimated their strength, their durability, their resilience, their ability to keep coming, the fact that they controlled the rate of the war and that all we could do was tax them. The journalists in Vietnam, it's very interesting. We were all, when you need a scapegoat, when a war doesn't work, you blame the journalists. And we were blamed for not covering enough American victories. Our sins were really, I think, greater. In fact, we covered American victories, and because we could go where our technology went, our troops went. Where we were weaker was covering the political strength of the other side, the ability to keep recruiting, to keep sending young men down the trails, the dynamic that went back to the French Indochina War and meant that they would always keep coming. We could not get that on film in television, and therefore, if anything, our coverage underestimated the resilience, the dynamic of the other side, and Tet, therefore, was a shock to Washington.
So you're not signing on to the shorthand kind of reiteration of what Tet was in this conversation today, but Tet was a watershed moment, it appeared, in the American public's understanding of that war and thereby the political embrace or lack.
Well, that's what you see. I mean, what is if George Stephanopoulos interviews George Bush, the president, and George Bush, the president, makes the case, sort of agrees with the parallel of Tet, is he agreeing with my rather somber view of Tet as an alarm clock for the American society that we are caught in an unwinnable war that is open-ended and eventually we have to go home and the other side is going to win? I mean, is he agreeing with that? I don't think so. I think that it was a huge chill to the people who were pro-war. It drove Lyndon Johnson out of office. What it really said was, what we're doing doesn't work.
David Halberstam, October 23rd, last year, on this show, talking about comparisons drawn between violence in Iraq then and Vietnam. Neil Sheehan, your friend David Halberstam, insisting there on the nuance that the understanding put forward of what Tet was all important in thinking about whether or not it was relevant in Iraq.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's wonderful to hear that David's voice there and to hear what he says there, because David had this great quality of going right to the heart of the matter.
Yes.
It was in the man. He was this great, large, big-boned person, well over 6 feet, and he used
way
his
over.
Hands when he talked.
Yeah.
David had an expression in those early years about to be a really good reporter, you had to know how to go for the juggler.
Yeah.
What he meant was you had to go directly to the point. And that's what he's saying there about Tet. Tet was, in effect, the American Dien Bien Phu, because it knocked the political props out from under the Johnson war effort. It did drive Johnson from office. It was an astonishingly bold stroke, after which nothing could ever be the same. I'll never forget the headline in one of the papers, which was that they had taken not the embassy chancery, but they'd taken the embassy grounds,
yes,
right in the middle of Saigon, where we in a country supposedly which we'd just been told by the commanding general that the United States controlled 67.5% of Vietnam, and here they didn't even control the grounds of the embassy in the middle of Saigon. I mean, it was a political blow of enormous importance. And nothing like that I've seen has happened in Iraq. So you have to keep these things in perspective, and David put Tet in perspective very, very well there.
Let me take a call from Frank in Newton, Massachusetts. Frank, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Ashbrook. This is mostly for Mr. Sheehan. You had just mentioned the NBN Phu, and Mr. Halberstam had mentioned Indochina. I thought one of his early great contributions, and yours also, particularly in that introduction you wrote to the Roy book, was telling people in the early 60s that we were making all the mistakes again that were being made and had been made in French Indochina in the early 50s, and nobody paid any attention.
Neil?
Well, we were saying that. We didn't go far enough, and David, I think, put his hand on that. What we didn't understand was that the other side, that is the Vietnamese communists under Ho Chi Minh, represented the national cause in Vietnam. Communism was a skin-deep thing with the Vietnamese. What mattered to them was their national cause, and they represented the national cause of Vietnam, and they were leading the war for the independence of Vietnam. We didn't understand that fully. Had we understood it and written that, given the political climate of the time, we would all have been sacked as Reds and traitors and proponents of communist ideology, et cetera. But
it came close enough anyway.
It came close, yes, because there was tremendous pressure. The president did try to get David fired, and unfortunately he. Unfortunately, that just reinforced David's position because once he tried that, the Times does not give in to political pressure.
Mm.
Yes, it was close. But had we didn't fully understand the fact that the other side simply hadn't captured the national cause. They were the national cause, and the Vietnamese were going to rally around them and pay whatever price it took to gain their independence.
David Greenway, our understanding of conflicts like this lives so much in the molds of past conflicts. It lives in the perspective and historical memory of correspondents like you and Neil and Bill. Look out on these conflicts today. Bring us that memory.
Well, of course, the government today is still underestimating the resilience of the other side and has done that since the Iraq War began. You remember all this stuff from Vice President Cheney. We're in the last throes. But Iraq and Vietnam are playing out in reverse. Vietnam in Neil's day and David Halberstam's day was a guerrilla war with booby traps and landmines and snipers.
Is that not the same as IEDs?
Well, it developed then into a war where tanks and artillery were being used.
Against U.S. troops.
Against U.S. troops. This started off with tanks and artillery.
Saddam Hussein's.
Yeah, which ended very quickly. Yeah. And it's playing out as a guerrilla war the way Vietnam began. So that's a difference, but it's all part of the same thing that at the end of the day is their will to have their own country or believe in whatever sect they believe in, and against a U.S. occupation going to be enough to prevail. Who knows that in the end? But we have never concentrated on the resilience of the other side.
But what about the candor and fullness of our national conversation about this war? I mean, how do you assess it? As we sit here now, here we are, spring of 07, you know, it rolls on. We saw the tortured path that the country's perceptions of Vietnam had to go through before, you know, after many years, there's an exit. What about the health, the accuracy, the acuity of the national perception today?
Well, the government is still talking about a light at the end of the tunnel, with a famous phrase in Vietnam, where, in fact, none of the goals that we set out to achieve are any longer achievable in Iraq. Perhaps they never were. So there's the great parallel, that the propaganda machine rolls on, and people in the press under great stress are trying to puncture it. It's much more dangerous in Baghdad than it ever was in Vietnam.
As dangerous as that was, Neil Sheehan, another bright and shining lie in front of the public today, and you know, with all the books and everything else that have been written, do we have Halberstam quality, truth to power spoken to a lie, if there's a lie standing there?
Well, you know, there are some very good reporters working in Iraq, John Burns, other people like that, who've written some wonderful coverage in the sense that it's gone right to the heart of the matter and the truth. They've talked about the resilience of the other side, et cetera. But it doesn't get through to people who are as deluded as George Bush and Vice President Cheney. And their pride is involved. I'm talking about Bush and Cheney and others who started this thing. They don't want to admit that they did the wrong thing. They don't want to admit they've wasted the lives of not only 3,000 Americans, but God knows how many tens of thousands of the people who inhabit Iraq, or the peoples who inhabit Iraq, because it's not a unified country. It's a divided society. They simply don't want to admit the extent to which they're wrong and do something about it. And they want to somehow hang on and hope that somebody's going to throw them a lifesaver, and it's not going to happen. It's sadly, in Vietnam when we lost, we were able to, the people who took over were an organized government who took over and imposed law and order. In Iraq, you've got the possibility of further chaos when we leave, and we will eventually leave because the political support for the war will reach the point where they'll have to pull the American troops out. All wars, in the last analysis, are political, and this is always more so for a foreign war that is of not a war of survival for the United States, but all wars. If Lincoln had not, if when Lincoln was up for renomination in 1864, if they hadn't taken Atlanta, he might not have been renominated.
The politics roll through always. Neil, David, Bill, let's listen once more to David Halberstam again from October last year, talking about how much more dangerous and difficult the ultimate withdrawal from this war will be for the United States.
Vietnam, when we left, they would have strewn our way with flowers. I mean, flowers all the way. There was no additional, for all the talk of dominoes, it was always indigenous nationalism, whereas this is a regional thing. It spreads through the whole region at a time where Islam is a fire. No, there's a payback on this, and it's going to be ugly, but the alternative is to keep doing something that does not work. This one's much meaner, much harder, and we're going to pay a higher price. But the real question, and the awful thing is, the eventual winner there, in the long run, is going to be Iran, a far more dangerous country. What this administration did was take the one regional opponent to Iran, a very unlikable country. I mean, let's assume that Iran, with the theological leadership, is very unlikable by our perceptions, and so was Iraq. But there was a counterforce. What we have done is weakened and destroyed the counterforce and made Iran almost surely the winner. I mean, one of the most interesting things that's happened in this is that the Iraqis that are the beneficiaries of our incursion, who are our Iraqis, have lined up with Hezbollah in the Israeli fighting in Lebanon.
David Halberstam, just last October, talking about what he saw as sure to be a very hard road out of Iraq. Neil Sheeran, our time grows short. This was your great friend, and we're sorry for the loss of his sudden death yesterday. If you were speaking to the country or to young journalists on this day, when Halberstam is gone, what would you say, what would you hope for in their work, in the determination, in what he stood for?
Well, let's remember him, and let's imitate him. That's what I would say to them. I mean, when you're in a struggle as a journalist to get the truth out, remember what David did, and take heart. And if you take heart in terms of what he did, you'll prevail as he prevailed. David, I think, prevailed in many, many ways. But one of the ways he did, he got the truth out, and that's what mattered.
Hold that torch high. William Prochnow, a final thought on David Halberstam.
Well, I think, follow his principles. Do what he did. I mean, he had one meeting with the American ambassador in Vietnam and was kicked out of the ambassador's office because he didn't want to talk about what the ambassador wanted to talk about. And, and he never tried again. He just said, to hell with it. Pardon me. But it's... The guy was not really a one of a kind, but damn close.
Be tough and go find the story. David Greenway, a final thought on this sad day.
I would say to reporters in his mold, have that much enthusiasm, have that much energy, have that much fun as he had out of life.
And courage, and we pray impact. Neil Sheehan, David Greenway, Bill Prochnow, thanks to each of you for being on this day as we remember David Halberstam. Thank you very much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.